Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I am hopping mad, and I want something in the middle.
Aha! Yep, absolutely. Yep, absolutely.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dan!
Monkey tennis?
Love pierced my foot on a spike.
With a chuckle, with a chuckle.
No.
Monkey tennis?
Radical. Awesome. Mega.
Monkey tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Okay. Monkey tennis?
Edmonds is a total wazzer of a guy.
Yes, and yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that?
Lad, this is great banter.
Yeah.
Back of the net.
Monkey tennis?
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Hello, dear listeners, and welcome to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. I am your new host, Digital Dame. Today I am joined by Adam Brooks.
I'm not expecting an easy ride, Ray. I know you're one of the toughest in the business.
Tom Dark.
The Anoraki Iraqi has been cancelled and will no longer feature on the show.
Nick Calder.
I was going to play London Calling by The Clash, but it's awful.
And Tom Stab.
Sadly, knowing me, knowing you, battled against poor scheduling, having been put up against News at 10, then in its heyday.
This week we will be overanalyzing Ang Lee and Limes, the one-off Alan Partridge special, from 2003. Over to you, guys. Have a ruddy bloody good time setting the chat amongst the pigeons. Aha.
Thanks, Digital Dave. And welcome to Monkey Tennis. So, Ang Lee and Limes came out in 2003. That's the extent of the background knowledge that I've written down, but I know a man who knows more, and that man is Tom Dark.
It's good to be back with my mega timeline. So, yeah, Ang Lee and Limes was actually aired originally, BBC Two, 9 p.m, 24th of March, 2003. So this is, yeah, a one-off that came quite a while after I'm Alan Partridge Series 2, interestingly. Basically about 3 months after. And I think the weird thing as well, if you look at the whole timeline of the APU, this one-off special will have been the last time that Alan was seen in a new show in character on the BBC until this time began in 2019. So we had 16 years of no new Partridge on the BBC. That is staggering, I thought.
Not to cut straight to the crux of Ang Lee and Limes, but what was the point of this? Was this
Because to me, watching it, before I knew that background about that it was aired basically in a prime time slot, it really had the whiff of a DVD extra to me. And so, and also quite heavily leans on archive footage or stuff that we have seen elsewhere. So I couldn't quite work out whether this is something that, that somebody has said, yes, we need this in and of itself, or was it just off the back of I'm Alan Partridge, they thought it'd be nice to have a bit more substance around the idea that he's released Bouncing Back.
I mean, I don't know, it does seem a bit of a weird one with the hindsight of, I mean, how many years, we're 19 years on from it now. I did find the original, so you can still find some of the original Partridge website pages, BBC Partridge website pages. So if you go to bbc.co.uk/comedy/partridge/life/anglian.shtml, you can find the page about this. So I thought perhaps for the context, it's worth reading what that page actually has. So this is obviously how it was sold, I guess, within the APU at the time. A documentary on the life and career of Norwich's finest broadcaster, Alan Gordon Partridge, is to be aired on BBC Two, 9 p.m. on the 24th of March 2003. In the programme, Alan is asked tough questions about his divorce, Toblerone addiction, and his autobiography Bouncing Back by formidable interviewer Ray Woolard. The documentary will show rare and previously unseen footage of Alan broadcasting on Radio Norwich, commentating on sports, and reading extracts from his book. He also talks candidly about the state of television today, his hatred of London, and his three rules for life. So that's the APU setup, which obviously all does make sense. But I think, yeah, from a real-life TV point of view, to have a one-off 3 months after and no follow-up, it makes you think, kind of, was this planned to lead into something else, I wonder, originally?
I would also just add to Adam's point that I'd assume this was a DVD extra, because I'd say it's more than a whiff, Adam. It's a stench. It absolutely stinks of a DVD extra. And it feels like it's essentially the stuff that was left on the cutting room floor that they've thought, can we extend this into a programme if only we could get Peter Bainham for a couple of hours? We've got a sort of loose idea to help stitch this all together, and that's what we've got.
I'd say its closest relative in terms of Partridge stuff that we've covered before is probably something like Open Books.
100%.
I mean, it effectively, Open Books came after this. Open Books is to iPartridge what this is to Bouncing Back, basically.
And also, just looking at Peter Bainham's IMDb, this is the last time he appears as an actor, I believe, within the APU. He comes back sort of as a writer and producer on Alpha Papa, and Alan Partridge and other less successful characters, but as a out and out actor, quote unquote, this is the last time he appears in the APU on screen.
It's also weird as well, the kind of questioning kind of almost why this exists, because in terms of Alan world building or universe building, it's actually like a very clever piece of programming. So we'll get into whether it's actually good throughout this episode, but in terms of building the mythology and particularly the Bouncing Back extracts, I think what then comes later in the Alan timeline with the Gibbons brothers and things like iPartridge, you can definitely see how they've used some very small details in this show to help colour in a lot of the Alan story that we haven't seen on screen previously.
I'd also say that it does something that becomes more commonplace in Partridge lore, which it starts quite subtly, but it builds up and it's very obvious by the end credits that this is a program that Alan himself has had some hand in the making of, in the shaping of. And I mean, I've got kind of more of a detailed theory about that, but this is like the prototype or the beginning of the sort of comedy we see down the line, where things are made by Pear Tree Productions and the joke is in the editing and in the editorial choices he's made. This is kind of the start of that idea.
Yeah, I did have that. I thought that, is that the case? This is the first time we've seen something made by Pear Tree, right?
Well, I don't, yes. Technically this isn't made by Pear Tree, which we'll come on to at the end when we talk about the credits, but it's definitely something that Alan has a hand in every aspect of this programme being made, even if it isn't his production company actually making it. And I think it starts early doors, because you have the host, Ray Woolard, introduces Alan as having had a fascinating past and an amazing future. And I thought the word amazing is the first giveaway that this is all Alan written.
Yeah.
And a couple of other things about the intro that I particularly loved. While he's giving him this sort of like lofty literary introduction, the evidence in the background is the front cover of Crash Bang Wallop, which goes no way to justifying this sort of an intro. There's also a little bit about Alan's, a bit of an Alan House update that it's worth talking about. So
is it an update or is it a lie?
Well, he's got a self-built five-bedroom house, which I'd presumed this is what he was making, is why he was in the static caravan, was to build this house, in 3 acres of land with access to a private stream. Well, we know later on, I don't know if he's in the same house, but he complains to Lynn about people having access to the bottom of his garden. I also had no real concept of whether 3 acres of land was impressive or not, so I did look it up. It turns out 3 acres is a decent amount of land. It's the size of 45 tennis courts. It's the size of 54 average-sized houses. It's the size of 468 parking spaces, 8 hockey rinks, 1/5 the size of Buckingham Palace, or 2 million times the size of a post-it note.
So it's something to brag about, then.
I think it is. I think it's a braggable amount of land, yeah.
Can I just dive into the Crash Bang Wallop VHS case that's on display before we get further into this episode, because I did go off on a bit of a tangent here, but I think it's worth a minute or two. So obviously you see the VHS case of this behind Ray, which in the APU, that's the first time we've actually seen the actual physical product, right? So of course we've seen a clip of the show, but never like the VHS box. Of course, this is worth a mention because, as we discussed last week, a eagle-eyed viewer spotted this VHS case in an episode of Little Britain. So in an episode called Hard Boiled Egg Eating of Little Britain from 2003,
Jed,
they're in a they're in a video rental shop, and you can see that video on the shelf. So it's just, I mean, it's amazing that it was spotted, but it's kind of good to see, yeah, that definitely is 100% the same thing that we see here. So I was wondering, what is there a link here? I did come up with a theory. I mean, it's ridiculous, but I'll just rattle through it. So aside from, of course, these both being BBC comedies that were shot and broadcast in 2003, of course, the art director on Anglian Lives was a guy called Simon Rogers. So this, I've done a bit of digging on IMDb here. Simon Rogers also worked on shows including Time Trumpet, The Thick of It, and Come Fly With Me and The League of Gentlemen. So you've got a link there, which is Mark Gatiss. Is it Gatiss or Gatiss? I always get that wrong. Mark Gatiss was the script editor on 8 episodes of Little Britain, including that one in 2003. And of course, also, so then you've got League of Gentlemen link. You've also got Come Fly With Me being a Matt Lucas, David Williams thing as well. So did Simon Rogers hand over this fake VHS tape to Mark Gatiss on the set of League of Gentlemen, or to Matt Lucas on the set of Come Fly With Me? In the interest of moving on, let's just say yes. That's my theory.
Yeah. A great bit of fact excavation, though.
Simon Rogers, if Alan, you're listening, get in touch, let us know.
Do get in touch.
Please do. So Alan is answering a phone call while the intro's happening, which I thought is funny, obviously, because there's a lack of professionalism, but also because of the position he's in when he's taking that call, it leads me to believe that he's holding cards for the host to read. Like, obviously he's written the intro, but it feels like he's also trying to kind of control the delivery of it, and only abandons that when he gets this phone call.
Because you see his eyes going, don't you?
Yeah, the eyes are kind of darting.
Yeah, it's a very subtle look from Peter Bainham, but it did make me laugh when he sort of does that little look. It's like, unbelievable. But my favourite bit of that is just like, Peter Bainham stops talking, and then you just hear Alan in the background go, excellent.
it reminded me a bit of there's a few points like that in iPartridge, aren't there? Like, doesn't he takes a phone call in iPartridge where he goes, oh, absolutely not, and just that kind of that lack of professionalism, I think we see displayed further down the line. Yeah,
absolutely not.
Yeah.
So there's some opening footage of Alan at work, already and immediately showing him either sheepish or annoyed with whoever's brought his tea. And I thought it was quite nice that the footage opens with him in a state of discomfort. There's no kind of relaxed, I'm at work having a fine time. He immediately brings up his divorce, I think through the medium of a phone-in, saying 50% she got is weighted against the man.
Is it at this point that he's also described as the best and best-loved radio presenter in the region? Something he also definitely wrote.
I don't understand why, for the purposes of this, meaning Anglian Lives, they're in a different studio for no apparent reason. It just doesn't really, again, it like, it doesn't really make sense in, I don't know, I don't really know why he's in a different studio. But then also, what I did notice, and I don't know, and this is a question to the group, did any of you recognise the top that he's wearing?
I didn't look it.
Oh,
because it's it was the black and white
when he's
sort of
playing the airbase. Same top.
It is indeed. Yeah. It is indeed that same top from I Know What Alan Did Last Summer when the tax inspectors come and visit. So obviously filmed around the same time. It makes sense chronologically that I'm Alan Partridge Series 2 came out and then this came out afterwards. So to the point of that we've kind of been making previously of, you know, is this stuff that was just left on the cutting room floor? Because it's a separate studio and a different setup and a different way of sort of Alan presenting, I do wonder if this is kind of maybe not rehearsal footage, but like sort of test footage where, because we saw in the DVD extras for this time, them obviously running through different interview scenarios and setups in a very different studio, in a kind of like mocked up studio.
Well,
when
that is in the actual one show studio. They did that.
Oh yeah. Sorry, yeah, of course. But it was kind of obviously sort of curtained off, so you couldn't see that. So part of me does wonder: was this stuff that is effectively stuff that's been left on the cutting room floor? Is it stuff that that didn't make the cut from the original scripts, but did make it as far as rehearsals in some kind of mock up studio? But then also, if you were doing that kind of rehearsal stuff, would you bring a Kestrel in?
Probably not.
Probably not. You just have someone pretending that they've got a Kestrel.
I mean, I think the reality is going to be, you know, they just couldn't get access to the studio or rebuild the set they had from the previous series because they'd have had a gap of quite a few months before they got shooting it. But it is a bit weird because, yeah, the fact he is in a different studio is quite noticeable.
Perhaps that studio just isn't Kestrel appropriate. Yeah. Maybe for a bird of that wingspan, you need a larger space.
And obviously, no audience. So we know that Series 2, I'm Alan Partridge, and Series 1, people say, oh, the second series, why was there a laughter track added? There wasn't a laughter track added. Adam knows very well. He went to go and see one of them recorded.
I was that laughter track.
So why is this filmed without a studio audience unless they were going to add CAD laughter later or whether it's just test slash rehearsal? I don't know. Maybe we'll never know.
I mean, my memory is very faulty of that period now, but I can honestly say there were no scenes in Anglian Lives that I remember seeing at the record of I'm Alan Partridge Series 2. I don't remember there being many offcuts at all, to be honest. So moving back to the introduction of Alan, I like that they tried to sort of add some drama to his upbringing by saying that he was born into a changing world of rationing, teddy boys, apes in space and the launch of ITV to try and make it sound like he lived in a more dramatic time than the rest of us. But taking that same tack, I figured since most of us were born in 1982, you could argue that we were born into a changing world of Thatcher, the Falklands War, the launch of Channel 4 and the end of the Ford Cortina.
Great.
So, you know, you can literally pick a year and try and make it sound equally dramatic.
Just to confirm, I was born in 1984, not 1982.
Yeah.
You did say most of us, to be fair.
I feel sad for you that you'll never have those touching memories that the rest of us share about the Ford Cortina.
Oh, no, I need to find what mine are now.
Just to go back quickly, the idea about him in the studio being rehearsal footage or kind of cutting room floor stuff, I think probably doesn't hold weight just because you think there are add-on Alan or extra Alan bits on the DVD releases from both series of I'm Alan Partridge, which is all scenes and offcuts from kind of larger scenes that we have seen. So I would think particularly because there definitely would have been a shooting day with Peter Bainham in the fake TV studio anyway. So, yeah, I think that probably isn't the answer.
No. I'm sure it isn't, but it's just kind of trying to speculate and work out why this thing exists.
There's a nice gag here that I think they continue in future Partridge and in other comedy, to be fair, where there's a voiceover over Alan, but then in the gaps between the sentences, you hear him say something terrible. In this case, he's giving kids, sick kids, secondhand toys and then telling them that they're rude when they admit that they've not heard of him.
I love that. So that was obviously from Naomi Knowing Yule originally, that section, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I was going to say, I don't know, a question to the group. Did any of you watch this show when it originally aired in 2003?
I don't think I did, and I was a huge Partridge fan, so I don't know how it passed me by.
See, I think I've seen clips of it, sections of it, maybe on YouTube over the years, because there were some things that I remember Digital Dave and that interview, but I don't ever remember watching the whole thing.
So to my mind, I feel like, particularly because of the way this show starts, you've got this kind of clips package of stuff we've all seen. I think back in the heady days of 2003, I'm pretty sure I started watching this and just went, oh, this is like one of those shoddy clips programs, and never watched the whole thing. And of course, with it being 2003, that is, you know, unless if you recorded onto VHS or something, it was kind of then just gone forever sort of thing. So, yeah, I think, yeah, maybe a few clips online over the years, but I think this is the first time I actually sat down and watched the whole thing.
So they mentioned that Alan replaced Peter Flint on Scoutabout. Peter Flint and Scoutabout also, it seems, referenced in iPartridge. So that's another reference that's been woven across the APU. He also entered the top eight of BBC Sports presenters, which I thought was really good. Obviously, it's funny because it's specific. The top eight is not really a thing. But I also, it did remind me of MySpace. So I did quickly cross-reference, and MySpace had just about launched when this was first broadcast. But I do think that the reference to top eight is a coincidence.
You've got the other reference there as well in this bit. He talks about being at Radio Smile at St. Luke's. And again, that also tallies with iPartridge, much like Peter Flint. In iPartridge, he wrote, I spent 94 wonderful months behind the mic at St. Luke's.
Yep, and I think we worked out on the podcast that that's about 8 years or seven years or something like that at Hospital Radio.
I liked the idea that the reference that he makes, it was Tom Stab's intro today, that he was up against the news at 10, which was then in its heyday. Because it's one of those things, initially it sounds absurd, you know, the idea that current affairs rise and fall like they're entertainment. But then it is true, you know, like ultimately they do have ratings. Those ratings do rise and fall. Arguably less people are watching the news at 10 now than they were in 2000, whenever this went out. So it's one of those things that often happens in Partridge where it sort of, it feels a bit absurd to say it, but there is a kernel of truth behind it as well.
I feel like in 2003 as well, like it was just very much a joke at like face value, because it's probably post-2003, the advent of proper rolling 24-hour news channels, which obviously would then have disrupted the appointment to view nature of the news at 10. So yeah, that kind of was initially a silly gag, which became quite a prescient point, probably.
They blame the cancellation of Know Me, Knowing You equally on the dumbing down of network TV and the fact that he killed a man on air.
The voiceover describes it as a single catastrophic hitch.
Brilliant. I don't know about anyone else, this all felt a little bit close to the bone just because of recent news events around Alec Baldwin and Rust. I think for every other time there's ever been a sort of Forbes McAllister reference, it's always felt quite funny, and this time I felt a bit like, oh, this wouldn't play very well now, would it?
Yeah, and I think when that happened, I think we did have a few people send us messages like, oh, lol, accidental Partridge, and it's been like, yeah, we're not going to go there. Someone's literally died.
I hadn't actually made that connection, to be honest, but you're right. Through that prism, this joke becomes something else that's less pleasant.
Yeah,
and less
not
fun.
Quite. I enjoyed the reframing of him being forced out of TV as him embracing a lifelong ambition to return to his roots, which is great for so many reasons. Obviously, you know, it's reframing the past. It's him being unreliable, but it's not like temporarily possible to have a lifelong ambition to return to your roots. You must have had the roots to begin with. So it's just nonsense as well. And is also, I think there's a real joke here about the level of editorial influence he's got. I wondered on a local, I mean, presumably this is supposed to be like a kind of low budget, you know, almost like a cable TV Wayne's World type setup, Anglian Lives, that on a show like this, he can A, be a big fish in a tiny pond, and B, have the kind of editorial control that he would never get if this was like a big deal or a proper national show.
Yeah, that's exactly how I thought this is supposed to be kind of seen, that the concept is, yeah, it's like a local TV show that's profiling notable Anglians. But I thought perhaps the nice concept for this in the APU is it's quite possible that Alan made one episode to profile him and then decided to make no more. because by that point the job was done. Because I also thought, actually, during this intro, you have this the voiceover saying things like, now single, a keen businessman, and always on the lookout for new investment opportunities. He's essentially made this show work like an extended advertorial for him.
Yeah, what I quite like about that, always looking for new business opportunities or something like that, it cuts to him picking a shirt off a rail in Norwich Market and just looking at it. Just a great business opportunity.
Sometimes a shirt can be a business opportunity. Yeah, I think that's entirely plausible that this is the one and only episode of Anglian Lives. Sorry, Delia, we're out of time.
Where are you?
There's a nice bit where they start talking about bouncing back, and immediately it comes up on screen with a £14 price point. Nice to see the retail price included in the captions there. And this is the point where he comes in with my opening line today. I'm not expecting an easy ride, Ray. I know you're one of the toughest in the business, which is brilliant, because by this point it's completely apparent that Ray is an absolute pushover, ready to just lob very softball questions that Alan's prepared for.
Did you note that when the first book reading is chapter one, Beginnings, which is, of course, the same as in iPartridge.
Although in iPartridge, it's not just a list of yes, no questions.
It's not. The text is not the same, but I did like that. You know, I think there are a few details in this programme that I quite like, that the Gibbons have bothered to basically take the detail and pull it through to their work.
Just looking at beginnings in iPartridge, I just really like the opening sentence. When I was an 8 year old, I suffered a nosebleed so profuse and generous, I bolted from the schoolyard and sought solace in the first class countryside of Norfolk. I do like that image of Alan just profusely nosebleeding.
And just like that, he's got you by the jaffers.
Yeah.
They elaborate quite nicely about his Toblerone addiction as well, at this point. Namely, that they tried to get the story sponsored by Toblerone, and Toblerone were up for it, yeah, apparently. But Alan drew the line at having a mini Toblerone on the cover because he thought it would trivialise the content of the book. Yet, fast forward a few years and suddenly it's all Alan Partridge drives this Kia.
I often think it's a bit of a shame that we miss out on some of the visuals of things described by Alan in sort of books or things like this. We don't get to see them on TV. And Alan describing how Lynn had to break a Toblerone that got wedged sideways in his mouth with a toothbrush is definitely one of them.
Yeah, and he uses the terminology like break its back. He kind of gives it this sort of humanising quality where, does a Toblerone have a back? Can you break it? I mean, technically you can, but it's the choice of language that really sets this joke off.
I like the hints at the negotiations before broadcast about how Alan's career shambles would be handled. But then this ends up being one of those bits where he's arguing with his own lines coming out of Ray's mouth. Like, he's clearly scripted the whole thing, but he ends up, as we've seen many times in the APU, losing an argument with himself. You know, he's like, you had a fantastic career in TV, yet you ended up walking away. That's the truth. Yes, I know.
I know it is as well in this first section. I just enjoyed the sheer heft of the laptop on the table next to Ray. Just, you know, very much of its time. Just, I enjoyed that. And I think Alan kind of seems to imply that Ray's wife beats him.
Yep, that's definitely there. There's also a reference a little bit earlier to an alcoholic producer whose wife has left him again, which seems so specific. I wondered if that was somebody who's referenced elsewhere in the APU, but I couldn't find any evidence of it.
It is, and I meant to look that up, and I've forgotten. I think it's in the chapter. It's in the chapter where he rents the apartment in Hyde Park or something around there. He does mention a producer who gets beaten by his wife.
It's not a Gabitas, is it? Oh no, he's a drink driver. I think the Gabitas thing.
I've got iPartridge here. I'll just have a quick look.
There we go. It's really hard trying to match the minor characters to their many crimes and or crimes committed against them, isn't it? It's an absolute rogues gallery.
And I've got a whole Gabitas wormhole to go down later as well, so strap in for that when we get to
it. What I like about this is that the questions we get from Digital Dave, just a quick note on Digital Dave, we get no context as to what it is, who it is, why it's there. It's just like, shall we have some questions from Digital Dave?
Yeah.
Sure, why not? Yeah. There's just absolutely no explanation of why it's not just Peter Bainham asking the questions.
The questions that Digital Dave poses as well are so odd and so strangely conceived that you kind of wonder who's put them together. I mean, it probably speaks to the general production values of Anglian Lives, but the questions are quite startlingly odd, and I'm sure we'll get to it, but I find Alan's responses quite strange as well. And he doesn't really give them much time to develop an answer. Not that there's much that you could really say to some of those questions.
I'd assumed that these were going to, when they first introduced Digital Dave, these are going to be questions that have been sourced from an audience of some kind. Like these are questions from fans of Partridge, but it's hard to tell, isn't it? Like you say, some of them are very kind of docile and some of them are sort of quite rude, almost like confrontational. We learn through the course of his answers to Digital Dave's first round of questions that his divorce from Carol took 2.5 years. And I particularly enjoyed when that somebody asked what advice he'd give to, like, you know, a young person going to London. He says, go for the day, visit Madame Tussauds, get the hell out.
And to be fair, I think he's kind of done American football quite well. It sort of is futuristic rugby. I think that's pretty good. Although I would disagree on his best way to cook a sausage. I think he loses confidence in his own answer, to be fair, but prick the skin to release the moisture, yes. But I also say just before you're about to serve, splay and then spread on the pan, and then you can ensure that you've cooked the middle as well.
Now, I think I'm hoping that Tom Stab is going to have a strong opinion on this, being essentially, let's say, head chef of the podcast. But I did find an old Guardian article where they were debating that, well, they were basically delving into this hot topic. And according to this article, in Nigel Slater's Real Food, you must never, ever, under any circumstances whatsoever, prick a British sausage of any kind of quality. If you do prick, you will only allow a good deal of the natural juices to flow out during cooking, making the inside drier and lessening the flavour. However, John Turode, the MasterChef judge, says, always prick them before frying to let the fat out, he advises, without troubling to explain why you would ever wish to do such a terrible thing to an innocent sausage. So two sides of the debate there, although it's probably cooking methods is what's important.
He goes on to say that advice also doubles for Greg Wallace. He doesn't really. But doesn't Greg Wallace look a bit like a sausage that should have been pricked some time ago?
Yeah, the sort of meaty filling has popped out of his neck and that's his head, basically.
Yeah. He looks like an unpricked sausage topped with an ecstatic egg.
This is off on a slight tangent. Did you guys see the thing about Greg Wallace commenting on his daughter's Instagram saying, print it, whenever there was a great photo, print it? Really enjoyed that. But look it up. That's fun.
That's lovely. I'm surprised that just final point on Greg Wallace. I'm surprised they don't feature him more often in the Partridge universe,
yes,
in the same way they refer to. He, you know, he is part of the lineage that goes Edmonds, Holmes, Wallace. I think
Nick Knowles, Dominic, whatever his name is.
Yeah, Dominic Littlewood. I feel like that's it. Yeah, Greg Wallace looks like he's won his role on the BBC in a competition. Applies much more to him than Dom. I think Littlewood is actually getting way too much attention when actually Wallace is the real target here.
I think that's a fair point.
Littlewood has pretty much no profile. Wallace, love him or hate him, has a pretty significant profile.
He's massive.
And I don't understand what other commissioners at the BBC thinking, yes, let's recommission him. A baffling commissioning choice for me.
So, back to the Alan action. It's anti-London night on Alan's
show.
So, I mean, again, this ties in nicely to the timeline because this is around the point that he's, you know, in Iron Man and Partridge Series 2, talking about being mugged or not appreciated when you go to London. So only natural that would then bleed into his show. As Nick said in the intro, he was going to play London Calling by The Clash, but it's awful.
You've also got, he calls Elvis Costello a bloody hypocrite for his song, I Don't Want to Go to Chelsea, even though he lives there. This is also where my intro quote, the Anaraki Iraqi has been cancelled, comes from as well. I missed that line the first time watching this. I was like, oh, a different time.
Yeah. Would you? I feel like there's a few things that we're going to discuss over the course of these shows where you just think, would you say that now? Probably not.
There's a bit of silliness in him mispronouncing Titanic and James Cameron as Titanic and James Cameroon as well, which we've seen this kind of thing in Partridge before. I always find it's a little bit obvious and a bit throwaway, but yeah. Fine.
There is something quite funny about Titanic, though. And keen to discuss curry post-film. Does it make sense?
It makes no sense. I mean, it
depends what time you're watching the film, surely. So let's not be too harsh on that.
Is it basically it's Burger King before a film for Adam. It cannot be Curry post film.
I suppose you could argue for a Curry post film if you're a freelance Partridge working at your own leisurely pace, and you're going to see a film at maybe 4 PM. But if you're starting your film at 8 PM and then go for a curry afterwards, and the film was Titanic, that's
he's probably an afternoon viewer. Oh, yeah. He's probably an afternoon viewer, isn't he? Because he's basically doing the graveyard shift radio. So
yeah, good point.
I think though,
either way, his bowels are getting destroyed.
Yeah, Alan is the sort of person that goes to see films at the cinema on his own, not because he just enjoys that, because he doesn't have much of a choice, because maybe outside of Michael, I don't think he has anyone that he could go to see a film with at the cinema.
He'd probably make Lynn go with him, whether she liked it or not.
Yeah.
Although you'd have to pay for her time, so probably wouldn't.
Yeah, and she'd have to sit in the row behind him and make notes about the cast so that he can refer back to them later.
In this section as well, the other note I had is about the question, where do you think TV is going these days? And the answer is just downhill. It's like, again, he definitely wrote all of these questions to kind of make a point, but I also love the fact that he never re-elaborates on these points as well. The answer he gives are just so short and don't really go anywhere, just downhill.
There's a lovely mixed metaphor as well where they say he frequently sails close to the bone, which I enjoyed. And then we get a caller, which I believe is Roy, but in this instance, not from Bungie.
Case of St. Edmunds.
Right, so Roy has moved, but hasn't let his move prevent him from ringing into Alan's show every day.
I also think, that is true. And I don't know if this is an appropriate point to say this now or at the end, but for me, this call is the absolute highlight of the show. I don't think there's loads of funny moments in this, to be completely honest, but I thought this call was actual comedy gold.
I would agree. I think the unseen calls that we get in this show, I think, are definitely the highlights, because we get returning callers Roy and Mary, don't we? And I think I would agree they are the high points, yeah.
I love that Alan basically batters Roy into submission until he apologises for wasting his time. and because Alan then says, speak to you again tomorrow, you know that this is a dynamic that plays out over months and months. You know, perhaps Roy would be even more stubborn when he first rings into Alan's show. But at this point, he's had a daily conversation with Alan. He knows he's going to get nowhere. He might as well just apologise and try again tomorrow.
I love how annoyed Alan gets with him as well. The point when he goes, I know, is so good. And again, with this speak to you again tomorrow, there's such a resigned tone to that. And I think we've probably covered that on the show before, that it's always feels quite strongly hinted that he basically has the same call as every night, isn't it? It doesn't really matter what point their argument got to on a Tuesday night, they'll still be ringing in on a Wednesday night.
And Roy is obviously Simon Greenall.
Sorry, did you guys spot as well, in this section, there's a really odd camera angle choice towards the end where it's kind of like filming upwards, like from underneath Alan, which I thought was just so odd, such an odd way to choose to frame half of a conversation like that in a radio studio. It doesn't really fit with any of the other camera angles you see, and it's not the sort of camera angle which has been used in any other Partridge radio studio segment. So I just thought that was really interesting.
That's weird. He's asked a question about theft, where he says he's only ever stolen other people's thunder and the limelight from Sue Lawley, which I enjoyed. His favourite place in the world, Gatwick Village, also, of course.
Well, Heathrow is an absolute tit of an airport, so it's only fair.
But I think we can be confident in that Nick Knowles also enjoys their stroll around Gatwick Village on a Thursday night, if I'm not mistaken.
And wasn't that Suze Kempner's favourite place as well?
Was it?
No, it was one of her favourite quotes that she said that summed Alan up perfectly, was that when he was asked what his favourite place in the world was, his answer was Gatwick
Village. Fine, so I basically assigned the answer to her as well, so that's fine. That is now her favourite place.
We also find out that to relax, and this does sound like a relaxing pursuit to be fair, Alan collects celebrity memorabilia. One of the items that he's collected is the script to Action Jackson, not easy to say. Were we aware of this? I can say for one that I wasn't, but having seen the trailer, I do now want to see it.
I'd 100% agree. I hadn't heard of it, watched the trailer, and I thought, that looks like a textbook late 80s action film. Yeah. It's Carl Weathers, he's topless, shooting guns. The fact the dialogue in the trailer alone includes things like the bad guy saying, to him, "You haven't learned your lesson." He says, "Teach me." And there's another line where he says, "What do you want from me?" And the bad guy says, "I want you to die." I was like, yeah, sign me up. This is brilliant.
He jumps over about three cars in the trailer as well. He like forward runs over about three cars.
So many explosions as well. Yeah.
I don't expect anyone's gone this far down the rabbit hole, but I wondered if Action Jackson was the inspiration for the name of controversial rapper Action Bronson as well.
Oh, maybe.
Want to research in your own time, or if you're a listener, or Action Bronson, why not get in touch?
So it's safe to say that none of us have watched the film Action Jackson. It is quite difficult to say. But we know a man who does. Producer Jed, who is, I don't think he would mind me saying, quite the expert when it comes to sort of movies of a niche capacity, sort of like B-movies and horror films and stuff like that. He has, of course, seen Action Jackson. So we are going to do our very first ever film review on the podcast, and we're going to pass over now to Producer Jed, and he's going to give us his review of Action Jackson.
Welcome, listeners, to Jed's 1 Minute Movie Reviews, a new segment that nobody actually asked for, but I'm editing this, so it's going in. Action Jackson is a 1988 Carl Weathers classic directed by a personal hero, Craig R. Baxley, who you might know as a director of other action classics such as Stone Cold, starring B-movie king Brian Bosworth, and Dark Angel, starring Dolph Lundgren. To put it simply, Craig knows movies. Carl Weathers plays the titular Action Jackson, and fuck me, he lives up to his name as a tough-as-nails Detroit super cop on the hunt for a power-hungry auto magnate who has decided to wipe out all of his competition. Sharon Stone plays a lady whose sole character trait is to tee up one-liners for Carl to knock it out of the park, but he never actually does. He does look great all greased up with his shirt off, though. What people tend to forget is that Action Jackson was made by the same people as Die Hard, Predator, Lethal Weapon and The Matrix, utilising much of the same cast and crew. It's not quite as awesome as all of those films, but people like me, with a certain type of trash sensibility, it really hits the spot for us. They really tried to turn Carl Weathers into the next action hero, but unfortunately he was let down by the script and the fact that he didn't have a gun for almost the entire movie. Look, this was the 80s. You need big guns, big hair, and big balls. Instead, they just engineered ways for him to jump off high things. Buildings, trucks, people. Didn't really matter, as long as he can jump off in slow motion and shout, "Whoa!" I give Action Jackson 7 on 10. See you next time on Jed's 1 Minute Movie Reviews.
Brilliant. We always knew that Jed would come through with an excellent review of such a classic 80s film as Action Jackson. So thanks, Jed.
Also, if you've been listening to Jed for more than 90 seconds, then promises about brevity have not been kept.
We will, if you haven't seen the trailer for Action Jackson, we'll post a link to it on our socials because it is really worth a couple of minutes of your time.
Should we quickly discuss the other bits of memorabilia that Alan collects to relax? He's got the dashboard of the Jaguar XJ6 as driven by Edward Woodward in The Equalizer, and also trousers worn by Tom Baker as Doctor Who. Obviously, the joke here is that he didn't get the scarf, which would obviously be really the only recognisable piece of Doctor Who character clothing. And I think it's kind of the same thing with the dashboard. It's the actual exterior of the car that would be the famous recognisable thing. So I think the overarching joke with these things is Alan is correcting rubbish celebrity memorabilia that basically has no value.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Back to the studio. He's with his guest, the funny Hawker, who actually I think does a pretty decent bit of wordplay here when they're going from super talk, super hawk, super kestrel, kestrel super, super tramp. It's the sort of wordplay normally that he would enjoy, but for some reason today it's riled him massively and he's not having it.
Yeah, it might just be because there's a live animal in the studio. He's a little bit off his game for this interview, I think.
We also learned that during this interview that he made a programme called A Country Ramble in 1994 for BBC TV. I wondered, were we aware of this already, or is this a detail that's just been thrown in for the first time?
I love the fact Tom's shaking his head and Adam's baffled. We literally discussed this as part of the Knowing Me, Knowing You special.
Yeah.
I mean, that was ages ago.
I mean, yeah, that was about 4 or 5 years ago.
Even but, I remember this one, yeah. Guys. Come on, keep up.
Come on. Keep right, up. Nick, talk us through it.
Well, just check my notes here for here we go, Country Ramble. DVD extra, I think, on No Me, No You.
Yes, of course.
Well, I can cover, a Country Ramble.
The Mike Oldfield stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So A Country Ramble originally aired as a standalone short, does that make sense? A segment within a show called Christmas Night with the Stars in 1994, hosted by Fry and Laurie. But then this was also aired alongside and packaged with commercially No Me, Knowing Yule. In 1995 onwards. So I do think it's, in a way, it's a bit weird because they use about two full minutes of what was only a 5-minute short anyway. But I did think, you know, to be fair, if a lot of viewers had missed this first time round, unless if you'd bought it on like DVD or taped it from an original broadcast in 1995, it is quite plausible a lot of people wouldn't have seen it. So it probably did feel like quite a lesser seen piece of Alan at this point. But On the other hand, lazy.
Quick question to the group. Did you recognise Amanda Crowther?
Did, but I couldn't think why.
From the APU?
I'm going to have to say no, I didn't.
She is the actress, let me scroll up, Melanie Hudson, and she appeared in Know Me, Knowing You. She is Nina Vanier, and she is also a member of the punk band in episode 1.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and Tom, you'll be pleased to know she has also appeared in Casualty. So,
thank God.
Good stuff.
Great. The Country Ramble bit is quite dull, wasn't it? Am I the only one that thought I wasn't getting much out of this?
I think Country Ramble is good. I personally think that in the context of this show, I think it comes a little bit out of nowhere. Yeah. But I think when you watch the Country Ramble on its own, It is a funnier piece of TV because it speaks to his solitary existence that he's walking on you know, his own on Christmas Day. It's a bit stupid throwing his watch in the pond and all of that, but I do think it doesn't work as well here just having 2 minutes of it without much kind of context around it. But as a standalone piece, I think it's good.
100% agree. Can I just shock you, Nick? I fully agree with everything you've just said.
Thank you.
When we get back to the guest, there's a sentence that made me feel a bit queasy, and particularly it got worse as it went on. As he says to a guest,
exactly what this is.
He says, "I'm sure there's a sicko out there that would love to put a mini camera on a homing pigeon and train it to believe that Knickers is home."
Yeah,
Knickers is home.
It says a lot more about Alan's dirty mind than anything else, doesn't it? Like, who's the sicko here, Alan?
Also, that's not what I thought you were going to say either.
Me neither. This is absolute like beef burgers to swans territory for Alan again, isn't it? Where he's attributing all sorts of behaviour to people, to hawkers and falconry experts that would never have. He's aghast that her kids feed mice to hawks as well. You know, very common practice. Everybody knows this happens.
He calls it technically weird, and it's like it's not weird at all. If you've got a bird, if you look after birds of prey, it's just what you do. Yeah.
Nick, was yours the defrosting of a mouse in the warm water?
It wasn't, actually. I was just keen to understand what the awful story was about Mark Armand.
Oh, okay. Who's got notes on this? I'm ready to delve into this one.
I know Mark Almond has sort of had quite public troubles in the past.
No. So, okay. Actually, this is genuinely a bit of an interesting social study. So I believe what this refers to is basically a really commonly known urban myth, which was Mark Almond. So basically, this was like a playground rumour / urban myth that did the rounds late 80s, early 90s. So the rumour being that Mark Almond was taken to hospital, had his stomach pumped, and there was like, they pumped out a pint of semen that had 9 different types of semen in it. I mean, yes, obviously bullshit, but you know, you hear that when you're like a 10-year-old kid and you go, yeah, that's definitely a true thing. So I looked into this a little bit and it's quite interesting. It looks like every kind of era, this rumour has existed about a different pop star. So it looks like in the 70s, it was Rod Stewart. So Rod Stewart even wrote about that rumour being attributed to him in the 70s in his autobiography. And it's also a bit similar, reminded me of the Richard Gere gerbil up the arse story, which again, one of those playgrounds, urban myths we've all heard. So it's kind of mad, like, where do these things start from? And also, it's kind of fascinating to know how these obviously, like, nonsense stories with no basis in facts, like, they travel so far and wide as well.
It's also reminds me of the ribs removal story that you hear about Prince, and then more latterly of Marilyn Manson.
I think that's
the least of his problems.
I think even heard that one attributed to Michael Jackson as well. So it's funny, you always get these slightly different
regional variations.
Exactly that. It's fascinating, but you know, I love the fact that in the script they don't really go into that in any detail at all. But I think the majority of people go, I know what that's a reference to.
Just back to the guest briefly. I thought it was quite interesting how long she would play along with Alan for. And I do wonder, amongst the writers of Partridge over the years, whether there's been some negotiation that's changed about how angry the guests are allowed to get, how much they can take what Alan says at face value, and how much they're sort of prepared to kind of play along with him. Because I think this feels like an example of, like, he could pretty much say anything to this guest and she's happy to take it. She just sort of rolls with it. Whereas I think there's been other examples in the APU where people are combative and, you know, as soon as he says something that's out of line, they call him on it immediately. So I just thought it was quite interesting that at this point, the guests are pretty much just there to accept whatever Alan says to them.
I mean, I guess it comes down to what kind of comedic point they want to make. So whether they want a particular guest to have a victory or Alan to have a victory, I guess is kind of, That's always going to be the narrative choice to make, isn't it?
Is it time to find out what Alan's three rules of life are?
I think so.
I absolutely love this bit of scripting where Ray asks what Alan's three rules of life are, and Alan responds with, "Well, Ray, I've got three rules of life." And you just see this, like, look in his face where he's kind of connected the dots. Does anyone have a note of what the three rules are?
It is have a cup of coffee in the morning. I mean,
so far with him.
Can't argue with that. Second one, don't trust anyone. And third one, floss.
Lovely.
We'll
come on to this as we continue to cover the road to stratagem and Alan's other stand-up. But I thought it's notable that this is probably across our next three episodes of Monkey Tennis, this is the first of three lists of rules to live by, none of which are the same as each other. And they get increasingly long as time goes on as well.
Does anybody have the list of celebrity names that he's got on his phone?
I think I can probably cover this, actually. So we've got...
I'll tell you what, I've got it down, so let's mark you. Let's see.
Let's see if we've got it right. It's Ball, Johnny, Ball, Michael, Ball, Zoe, Boycott, G. Let's come back to that. Brandreth, Carling, Curry, Edwina, Curry, Tim, Curries, Curry Favours, which is the British curry house that puts raisins in curries. Ugh, but they deliver. Hamilton, Christine, Hamilton, Neil, Hamilton, David, Diddy.
You got it. 10 on 10.
Also, a great stickler for accuracy in that Edwina Curry is the first of the curries because her surname is Currie, and all the rest are Curry.
Correct.
So which out of those names would you like to have the most context about how he got their contact details and why is it Diddy?
Well, I feel like people that he would have in his phone would be, I look at things like Christine and Neil Hamilton. I sort of like, I can believe that. Tim Curry, I'm not buying it.
No, that's just a joke on Curry again, isn't it? Yeah. Also, I didn't realize like Alan is so curry obsessed in this episode.
Is this celebrity naming what leads us into a long stretch of Brian Ferry content that we've seen before as part of Comic Relief?
Before we get into that, is there anything to delve into in any of those list of names? I mean, Jeffrey Boycott has gone very UKIP, convicted of assault, bad times.
Brandreth obviously appears later in the APU in Nomad. Alan bumps into him. And he says something about dining al fresco, and Alan says, "Brilliant! I've got no idea what he's talking about, but simply brilliant." Which I enjoy. Carling, I assume, is Will Carling.
Yeah, I would imagine so. Yeah.
And who's David Hamilton?
So David Diddy Hamilton. AKA or usually known as Diddy David Hamilton. Apparently, he was given the Diddy name by Ken Dodd. He's hosted things such as Miss TV Times, the TV Times Gala Awards, the World Disco Dance Championships, Top of the Pops Seaside Special.
Perhaps TV Quick Man of the Moment Award Ceremony 1994.
Yeah, I think so. like kind of basically quite a light entertainment kind of radio and TV face back in the day.
Oh, I assumed when he said Diddy, he meant Diddy. P. Diddy.
So you thought in the APU, Alan Partridge had P. Diddy's phone number.
Well, that's why I said, why is it Diddy? Because I assumed like he would not have
Diddy's phone
number. It would be quite funny that he would somehow have P. Diddy's phone number.
But I'm pretty sure also at this time he'd have been calling himself Puff Daddy. Surely P. Diddy
Nick
was
is,
yet to come.
I think Nick is correct.
What year are we talking? It's 2003, isn't it?
It was the Puff Daddy years.
We now cross like a top stab for Diddy Watch.
Jed, just put some P. Diddy music in quick. We can't be stopped now, because it's Bad Boy for Life. Basically, I think Diddy David Hamilton, he's basically a Tony Blackburn type figure. And apparently in 2012, at the age of 73, he danced to the hit Push It with fellow DJ and close friend Tony Blackburn as contestants on the charity show Let's Dance for Sport Relief. So, yeah, Tony Blackburn world.
Diddy Watch. So, in 2001, he changed his name to P. Diddy. So, by this time, he was P. Diddy, but he didn't become Diddy until 2005. So, he wasn't Puff Daddy. He was P. Diddy at this time, but not Diddy.
But crucially, not in Alan's phone, as far as we know.
Yeah. Definitely not in Alan's phone, no.
So in terms of whether he changed his name or not, did he? We can't be stopped now, because it's Bad Boy for Life. This tips into a lot of Brian Ferry content that we've already seen and covered as part of our Comic Relief episodes. It did make me question, the line in my notes at this point is, did Anglian Lives have to be 30 minutes? Because this is a long stretch of stuff we've had before. Admittedly, if you didn't watch Comic Relief, you know, you might not have been able to get access to it, but it does smack of filler.
I mean, I feel it's a similar thing to the Country Ramble. Like, if you missed that originally in 2003, it would have been very hard to have seen it again if you didn't have it on VHS. It's Comic Relief from 95 and 99, isn't it?
Yeah, I didn't. I mean, we've seen it. It's fine. I don't think it's one of the funniest things. We didn't even get to see Nick Pellitz, although I do still find it funny when Alan gets a cream pie on the arse. That is quite funny.
Not my arse, not my arse.
I still love when he says to Brian Ferry, "It's fine if you don't remember, but don't lie." Yeah. That is still an absolute golden line.
You're saying that that's fine. I really think that that second Comic Relief section with Brian Ferry, not the Brian Ferry bit, but that year is absolute gold that year of the Partridge stuff.
Well, that's the Kate Bush so medley good. Year as well, isn't it? Which we will come to.
And it's
next week.
It's when he's broadcasting live on the telly and on radio simultaneously, and obviously that.
And Michael's dressed as a clown.
And he's Charity Charlie.
Yeah, that's it.
A couple of lovely standalone lines come up after this. The one I enjoyed was, Alan is one of the few people who genuinely enjoys charity work. And also when they say to him, you have two children, he says, yes, both unplanned. And unfortunately, they do pick up on it.
I thought there's quite a nice lead into the next section as well. When Ray says to him, tell me about your relationship with women. Again, you'd think like, fine, Alan's basically scripted this. He could be using that to go somewhere to make some kind of point, but it comes down to Alan saying, I don't like hairy women. And but then what I quite liked, and whether it's intentional or not, we then get Mary on the phone, who I think we've referred to as Hairy Mary in the
Hairy
past.
Hairy Mary. Yep. You Hairy Mary?
What did you guys think of this bit? Another highlight?
I personally didn't think this was anything like the highlight that Roy's call was. Hmm. I mean, it's odd anyway. Like the voice, I find the voice a bit troubling. I won't lie.
Her voice is actually genuinely quite disturbing, isn't it? I think
it's Amelia Bulmore as well who's doing the voice.
Yeah, I don't think it's that. I didn't find this bit all that funny, but I think it's mainly because I find the voice genuinely troubling.
And the fact
Alan.
And the fact she sent him a doll that was hers when she was a baby.
Yeah.
And you hear her get visibly upset and annoyed when she finds out that one of the shoes has gone missing.
Yeah.
You just hear her go, ugh.
it is exceptional voice work, though, with that crying and laughter. Yeah. That is genuinely really, really good, but I just don't find it that funny.
It feels a bit more actually. this would actually fit in a bit better in like a kind of Chris Morris Jam type world.
Yeah. It's very Jam, isn't
it? For the Alan world, it's actually quite dark, yeah.
Yeah, I think the best thing about this scene for me was that you had Annie Lennox in the background. That was the best bit for me.
I think my favourite bit is you see him press play on what I think is a mini disc player.
Yeah, and it says no disc. Player
says no track.
I don't know if that's intentional, but I must admit, I think
that's amazing.
You know what? I think if you, in a Pear Tree production lens, you could argue that's intentional.
Yeah.
But that's the genius of this, right? Anything in the APU which is made by Pear Tree, if they get something wrong in the real world, they can say, well, that was just deliberate anyway.
Yeah.
Although I do have to stress, this is not a Pear Tree production.
And we'll get to that.
We will come on to a credit sequence that I think deserves more analysis than anything.
Correct.
Any credit sequence we've ever looked
100%,
at.
100%. Yeah.
Is it time to talk about Alan's new book?
Yes, please.
I've written very sketchy notes on the plot rather than do it verbatim. So here are the edited highlights. TV entertainment, year 3000, 3D TV on their wrist, travel on monorails, set after a nuclear ratings war, one of the stations on Pluto, Jack Jupiter, main character, each day is 10 hours long because they've gone metric on time, Alec Parsons is the rebel intent on a 7-day week, back in time to the present to see what a week is like.
I mean, it's a shame Nero Costa didn't get a look in on this one.
Yeah.
That would have taken valuable pages away from Alec Parsons.
not to be confused with Alan Partridge.
Of course not.
Did you have monorails like in Gatwick Airport? Did you have that bit down?
It's futuristic.
Also, going metric on time would not make each day 10 hours long. That's a nonsense.
I mean, if you want to start picking fault, I mean, we'll be here for a long time.
So. A 3D TV on your wrist?
Nick, show us your wrist. It's basically the same thing.
It's not 3D and it's not a TV.
You could watch Apple TV on that, can you?
No.
Well,
listening to this in the future...
Yeah. Future me.
Let us know.
Future me is laughing at old me for so many reasons. Right, is it time to find out who the future faces of TV are and who Alan thinks?
Only if we can go via Legoland.
Yeah, I thought that he goes to Legoland to think.
You've got to do a day, yeah.
Yeah, and he becomes convinced that a Lego robot is the chief commissioner at the BBC, and sees a bird. I don't have the type of bird, but a bird eating a beef burger. Not a swan, however.
This is another example of I would like to see this actually happen.
What, a swan eat a bird eating a beef burger?
Alan, go to Legoland. Bye.
For me, I think the two highlights from this book reading are like a young Malcolm Brandon from It's the Waterfront. So yeah, good.
Brilliant.
Absolutely mangled. And they're just a very casual, skipped over reference to basically having a hose hanging out of his exhaust pipe, which is pretty much exactly the same. This is handled in exactly the same way in the I Partridge book when he returns from Dundee. He's writing about Lynn, saying she quickly washed and shod me and then began the drive home with the hose pipe dangling from the exhaust like the tail of a giant mouse. So what we can take from that is Alan has had two aborted suicide attempts. Bit bleak, but those are the facts.
We didn't write it. I think this is around this point, we're at our last visit to Digital Dave. I love Alan's increasing dislike and disdain for Digital Dave. And a question to the group. Is it simply because he finds the voice annoying, which we can see that he does? Is it because he has no control over the questions? Is it because he's scared that it's a device that they've put in so that they can ask him harder questions? Or is it something else?
I wouldn't describe anything.
I think it's just exacerbated with the format. Like, it doesn't quite work. He gets annoyed because some of the... Is it life and wife that they can't tell the difference between? He's just exacerbated by the whole thing, I think. He's, fine.
Because would it not be implied that Alan is... pretty much scripted this whole thing anyway, so I don't think he should be getting annoyed with the questions.
My theory is that Digital Dave was his idea, and that he had imagined it would sound better than it does. and so he said, wouldn't it be fun if some of the questions come to me through a Digital Dave character that I've created, copyright Pear Tree, with a sort of Stephen Hawking voice box, and then when it's come through, it doesn't sound good. He's embarrassed because it's his idea, and so he's just sort of dismissive of the whole thing. Is it time to talk in great length about the end credits?
God, I think it is. Yes.
And if this isn't what you were listening to Monkey Tennis for, then you're listening to the wrong podcast.
I think we know how much our listeners enjoyed us going down teletext rabbit holes. So, you know, very much in the same vein. A list of credits that is on screen for probably 10 seconds is going to warrant probably 20 minutes of chat. Strap in.
I do think there is a lot to learn from this, and it is a series of punchlines in their own right. So firstly, they give thanks to UK Conquest, presumably for showing a very brief or alluding to Skirmish, the military
base. Oh, well, yeah, the Skirmish TX details are actually part of the credits.
Yeah.
Weekdays, 11:30 a.m. And 4:30 p.m.
Presumably a deal breaker for Alan. They also thank Cater Familius, which I wasn't sure if that what the reference was there.
Yeah, I couldn't work that out. I feel like it's perhaps a bit of a play on a Latin phrase, but I couldn't quite decipher what the joke actually was. So if you know, get in touch.
Please do. Contact details coming up. I enjoyed that they credited the archive footage to BBC, Comic Relief, Pear Tree and Meteor Video. So a mixture of real and fake there. You know, some of those actually did go out for Comic Relief on the BBC, so it's not completely made up. And then we get into the nitty-gritty facilities on this programme by Blue Barn Video, which we have to assume is an offshoot of Blue Barn Media.
Yes.
So that's the Gabitas connection, isn't it? Well, that's part one of the Gabitas connection.
Yes. Now, I've got some Gabitas stuff, which we can either do now or in a minute, because I feel like there are basically... There's a Gabitas wormhole, and there is... also a separate bombshell in these credits. So which way around do we want to do it?
I think let's exhaust the credits and then let's tip into Gabitas world. So the next line I enjoy, research by Lynn Benfield, presumably as Lynn has been tasked with doing additional research about Alan, a man who she must, what, at this point, know precious little. Like, you know. Associate producer.
Who wants to tackle the surname here?
I'll give it a go. Sonia Puszkowskaja.
I would go with Pachovska.
Is this Sonia Allen? Sonia,
I'm saying yes.
Is this kind of like when an actor is getting quite big, but they're not that great, so you give them an exec producer credit to keep them sweet? Sonia's been made associate producer, even though she's basically just bringing Alan sandwiches.
Well, it's a way for Alan to fiddle the books and just pay her a handsome salary for doing so all.
Yes, that.
But I do think in the APU, this is the only time we see her full name.
I believe so, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I can't see why it wouldn't be the Sonia that we all know and love so well.
Yep. Next credit, studio director Phil Gabitas. That Gabitas wormhole, as promised, coming up shortly. And then probably the pinnacle here, that this is an Apache production. So not Pear Tree, and I wonder either they... the writers hadn't thought of that gag to make it a Pear Tree thing, or to give the illusion of it being editorially sound, they funneled it through Apache, which most people wouldn't trace back to.
Oh, but actually, thinking about it, because obviously he closes Pear Tree in series one. In series two, when he's got Pete the South African, it's all about Apache Productions, isn't it? So I guess probably
that's true.
Pear Tree was dissolved and then undissolved later down the line somehow. Doesn't make sense.
Apache is the phoenix that rose from Pear Tree's flames.
Yes.
So, Tom Duck, talk to us about Gabbitas.
All right. So, I just... It's little details like this I find fascinating because it's like, why are there discrepancies? So, as you've rightly pointed out, in these credits, you've got Blue Barn Video. And it also says, so studio... Blue Barn Video, studio director is Phil Gabbitas. In the iPartridge book, it's Pete Gabbitas. And Pete Gabbitas is the MD of Blue Barn Media, not Blue Barn Video. I just think things like that are interesting because there are so many details that they take from one medium to the next and have it exactly right. It's like, is there a deliberate reason why they change it from Phil to Pete, Pete to Phil, vice versa?
I think there's a 50-50 chance here. 50% is that they've just taken their eye off the ball and didn't think this was a key detail. But 50% of me thinks it would be funnier if you had Blue Barn Media run by Pete Gabbitas and then his sort of underperforming younger brother, Phil,
right,
is given Blue Barn Video that puts out tat like this.
Yeah, that could work.
I don't think there's another option, is there? It's an error.
Well, it... Yeah, it's either an error or it's not. And if it's deliberate, it's a bit of a weird, deliberate choice. Because Pete Gabbitas does get quite a bit of airtime in the iPartridge book because he's basically seems to be one of Alan's few actual friends. And if you go back to the crash, bang, wallop clips that we see in I'm Alan Partridge, the producer there is Phil Gabbitas. So, again, that's in line with this show, but not in line with the book. And I was like, okay, well, that's fine. I've done enough research into that. But then I found this. So in 2006, Armando Iannucci directed some adverts for Nationwide, which I didn't realise. However, I do remember the adverts. And in one of these adverts, basically, there is an actor playing a bank manager and he has a name badge on that says Phil Gabbitas. So I just like the fact there is something going on in terms of Armando Iannucci universe, the AIU.
So, okay, I've got a third theory now then. Is it possible that Phil Gabbitas is the name of somebody that Armando Iannucci knows but doesn't like, and it got to the point where the name was becoming too prominent to keep the real name of the person that he doesn't like? Like
it's not very different.
Say the real Phil Gabbitas, if you're using his name on, like, you know, the big tentpole Alan Partridge projects, he's got some legal comeback. Whereas if you change it to Pete, it's different.
There could have been some kind of court injunction, like from the makers of Cluedo, perhaps.
Yes.
It could also be, for whatever reason, it's a name that Armando finds funny or something like that as well. And I think what we should do as well, just, I reckon you guys will recognise this advert. So, Jez, if we could just play a little clip of this in now, to see if you guys remember.
Hi there. How can Old Bank help you?
Well, I've just come back from holiday and it seems that the bank has charged me for taking my money out abroad.
So, what do you want me to do about it?
Well, I was just wondering, it's my money, why have you charged me?
Well, you know when you were on holiday, right?
Yeah.
And you had that smashing meal down by the harbour, yeah. And that waiter come over.
Waitress.
And he brought you the bill. Did you leave a tip?
Yeah, of course I did.
Oh, well, there you go, you see. That charge is like our tip. And at the end of the year, we had all those tips up. And he pays for the bubbly at the shareholders' meeting. Got to have a bit of bubbly having the shareholders.
Ooh. But that's my money.
Do you like dancing? Because if you like to dance, that's the only place to be.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, we go crazy.
At Nationwide Building Society, we don't make additional charges for using your cards abroad. Nationwide. Proud to be different.
So, Phil Gabbitas for Nationwide there.
I can say I don't recall that advert, but absolute gold star for digging out that absolute deep cut. I can't believe that.
It's Mark Benton, the actor. That's it. He was in Strictly a few years ago, and has done various comedy bits and bobs, including the very underrated Early Doors, which I'm a big fan of.
And just to add one more credit discrepancy. If you look again at the Crash Bang Wallop credits, there is a credit there that says additional material by Ross Woolard. So that's essentially Ray Woolard. So again, another small change.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, and that one's hard. I mean, the fact there's two of them makes it harder to explain.
Hey, there you go. I told you there were some bombshells coming, and God, I was right.
Oh, I feel genuinely shelled. So, yeah, I think the great thing about these credits is that the thrust of it is that everybody involved in this is a friend of Alan's or an associate of his. And I wondered if this is the sort of thing where, you know, local TV stations at this time would often take cheaply made content from elsewhere. And anyone who's kind of watched, you know, those sort of like regional channels will see that. So is the narrative that Alan has basically built this show from scratch, knowing he could sell it to local TV, and they're so starved of content and budget that they basically have to take it. So, you know, it's like if he pays... Or pulls in some favours from Blue Barn Video and Apache, he can basically get a half hour, you know, show bigging himself up after one of the roughest periods of his career. And he knows it's going out on TV.
Yeah, and also he's basically got his mates a fully commissioned TV show, even though if it is only in a region. Because actually around this time, like regional TV was very much a thing. And it was even things like, Nick, if you remember this, remember there was a short-lived... local like student TV station in Southampton when we were there.
I don't think I ever watched it, to be honest, but I...
Oh, I mean, nobody watched it, but it was a thing that existed.
It was a thing,
and, you know,
that happened.
In that kind of like early 2000s era, I think people were still trying to make, yeah, almost kind of Wayne's World cable TV type thing, like channels be a thing. So it would tie into that. I mean, because it would either... It feels too budget to... It doesn't feel like it's supposed to be BBC Norfolk or anything, does it? It doesn't feel like it's supposed to be well, probably what BBC Anglia. It doesn't feel like it's supposed to be that level of show, does it? It feels like it's supposed to be very much a two-bit, really local station that nobody's actually watching, right?
And just the last thing, obviously, as the credits are rolling, we see Peter Bainham asking Alan if he wants to go for a drink, which is, you know, something Alan has paraded around various establishments of Norfolk and on the phone talking to people, asking them if they want to go for a drink with him. And it does feel, it feels a little bit like Alan, there's a bit of kinship between the kind of people that Peter Bainham's character Ray is and Alan.
Well, I think it's kind of proof that actually come the end of the show, Alan's kind of lost any sense of, not respect as such, but there's no friendship there, when actually we know that Alan's starved of kind of any kind of friendship and affection, and that normally he would probably take this kind of an offer. But yeah, I think he basically holds a very low opinion of Ray, which is why
yeah,
he doesn't.
I think I read this as a bit of a pecking order thing, because he's like, because he does say, who's going, is it just you? And then I really enjoyed, there's a very long pause where he goes, I'll just go back to Norwich. So yeah, I think it's like, he basically thinks he's above hanging out with somebody like Ray, who in the APU is, I would assume, a less successful broadcaster.
Yeah, and Alan is sort of, you know, okay, has fallen on a bit of a rough time, and so has had to stoop to making a programme like this to sort of turn his fortunes around and do a bit of PR damage control. So, stepping out of the APU and back into real life, was Anglian Lives worth making? Did you enjoy it? What's the verdict here?
I think the answer to that kind of comes with knowing really the context of why it exists in the first place. And I don't think we do know that context. So it's kind of difficult to answer, was it worth it? It's because we don't really know what it was for, essentially. It's just a bit of a weird sort of anomaly in the APU that doesn't really go anywhere, set anything up. It seems, I get why open books exists. I don't understand why this exists, but it feels like there is maybe something that we're missing, but not quite sure.
In fact, the more I think about it, the more I do think it's a real shame that this doesn't exist to tee up a real bouncing back book, which also, seeing the prop book on the set of this, I'd love to know if any of those prop books still exist anywhere. Like, if anybody, I mean, this is a long shot, but if anybody listening works on any of these projects, has a copy of the prop book, I'd love to see what they look like in situ these days.
I'd also really love to know, bringing it back to Iron Man and Partridge Series 2, whether any of the footage of books being pulped were actual fake copies of Bouncing Back, or whether that was literally just stock footage of pulping happening to someone else's Paul Book.
I also think my view on this is, you know, with taking the context to one side, I didn't think this was funny enough, irrespective of the role that it was sort of designed to play. There's too much archive footage that I'd seen before, and the original content felt, whether it was meant to be or whether it was offcuts or whatever it was, I just didn't think it felt that funny. And probably not one maybe for now, but I also felt like I've become so accustomed to the strength of the writing style from the Gibbons that this Alan and this style of writing kind of felt just from a previous time, and that the writing has moved on so much that this just stood out as quite mediocre, to be honest.
I felt a lot more charitable to this when I thought it was a DVD extra. I would have argued it was an above average DVD extra, but a below average standalone 9 PM BBC Two program. And I think a lot of it comes down to the use of archive footage, even if some of it was quite rare, but also just like there's a bit of a cavalier approach to how much footage they use as well. Like 2 minutes of the Country Ramble, I wasn't really into. The Brian Ferry bit went on for far too long. Why are we seeing a whole interview between him and a guest on his radio show? It doesn't really make sense in the context of what this is supposed to be. That said, there are some really nice throwaway lines. There are a few universe building moments where we find out a bit more about his divorce from Carol, his attitude to his kids and things like that. So I did enjoy it, but I think I enjoyed it more when I believed it was, you know, a little bit of a throwaway bonus rather than something that's supposed to be sort of taken on its own merits.
And I also thought that the Digital Dave stuff had the basis for actually something really funny. And what they do with it is quite unremarkable. The answers to those questions, I think, in the hands of the Gibbons could have revealed some really kind of funny moments. And his responses to those questions, maybe with the exception of his three rules for life, which is quite funny, but they're really short answers. There's very little humour in them. But I just felt in the hands of if this had been kind of with that, with the Gibbons, I think they could have done something really interesting. I think ultimately I just felt like this felt a little bit lazy, which is a bit of a harsh thing to say, but the standard's so high that when it doesn't quite deliver, I think it stands out. And for me, this stood out as not the best.
Can I just shock you, Nick? Your point about the Gibbons brothers, I completely agree with. I think we've been so spoiled with this renaissance of Alan in these last decade or so. And I can kind of actually, watching this and watching a few of the other things that we're covering this series, really makes me kind of see how and why Steve has said in so many interviews that the Gibbons coming in and being involved in the writing process breathed new life into the character and made him exciting for him again. Because if you put the Gibbons era next to some of the stuff in here or some of the stuff we covered this series, it's chalk and cheese in terms of quality, which, you know, I think the main crux of, you know, the other stuff that we're covering in this series when it comes to The Man Who Thinks Is It and other less successful characters is how the Gibbons having a solo, so to speak, run at doing a new live show, how that compares to the other two previous live shows and this. Because, yeah, I think we've been spoiled in the last 10 years, and it really does kind of put into perspective how good the Gibbons are. Whereas if they got their hands on this, it would be 10 times better.
Yeah, I agree with everything everyone's saying. Bang on. I think it's interesting as well that I remember when we covered Open Books, and once we kind of really got into the discussion, we're like, oh, actually, we all really enjoyed that. And it was kind of a better proposition than we thought it was on paper. Like when you actually sit down and kind of delve into the script. And I think, again, when you compare this to that, you see how good something like Open Books is. This does feel quite lazy and quite slapdash. Now, I think the interesting point with the 2003 context, particularly because if you go right back to the BBC website, part of the selling point of this documentary is saying it will show rare and previously unseen footage of Alan. So at the time, I think that there was maybe kind of going, look, we've got all these little Alan shorts that have been used over the years, and kind of we want to find an opportunity to put them into one place for the fans. But again, it could have been done in such a better way, or just don't bother at all, arguably. I wonder as well, you know, we know historically how much the writing has gone down to the wire in pretty much every Partridge project possible. So whether they've actually gone, oh shit, you know, our show's only 27 minutes long and it needs to be 28. Well, let's let another minute of Country Ramble run. I wonder whether kind of any editorial decisions like that had to come into play. But I do think weirdly, with the benefit of hindsight and all the world building that this adds to, in a way, it feels better knowing that a lot of the detail in this contributed to what the Gibbons brothers would go on and write. So that there's a weirdly kind of like a benefit in the future. But yeah, it's not great. I mean, I think, you know, the comic relief bits on their own were great. The Country Ramble on its own was great. Having 2-3 minute sections of those in a whole half hour special, which should arguably be all new stuff, feels a bit like a wasted opportunity. And especially when you have, like, you know, the first 10 minutes is nearly all just kind of old clips of him on the day to day and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's a shame. And I think you're right. If they were going to do something like this now with the writing team, it would be a brilliant piece of programming and something refreshing and new. Whereas, yeah, sadly, this is not it. But I will say I thought the Roy call was great. I thought the Merry call was great, if not disturbing. So, yeah, I did enjoy seeing the new bits of him in the studio, but they're probably not strong enough to justify a whole half-hour special that's brand new.
So there we go. We've not had the time of our Anglian lives, but what did you think about Alan's one-off special? Or, indeed, are you the original Phil Gavitas and looking for an opportunity to clear your name? Get in touch with us on Instagram at MonkeyTennisPod, Twitter at ThePartridgePod, Facebook.com/ThePartridgePod, ThePartridgePod@gmail.com. Leave us a voice note on the Monkey Tennis hotline, 07923 600 017, which might be used in a future episode. Or if you've just been enjoying what you've heard and want to throw a couple of quid our way, it's ko-fi.com/Monkey Tennis. All contributions gratefully received. Your homework for next week is to uncover the man who thinks he's it, Steve Coogan's 1998 stand-up special. If you can't find it through a paid source, I'm sure you'll be able to find it through some other more nefarious methods. Tune in next week to find out what we thought about, specifically about the Alan section of Steve's big show when he's at the arguably the height of his comedy fame. See how Alan fares nestled among some of Coogan's other characters. Until then, from all of us at Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge Fan Podcast, thanks so much for listening and goodbye. Yeah. It's Bad Boy, baby. Yeah. Neptunes. And we won't stop. Because we can't stop. Yeah. Let me tell you something. Yeah. Sometimes I rhyme slow, sometimes I rhyme quick. I was on 125 in St. Nick, chilling with this chick named Tom DeLeo. Was a hot girl and everybody wanted to slay her, but she wasn't fond of players, only wanted ballers to spoil her. Six figures and camcorders. So what you trying to tell me, dear?
I am hopping mad and I want something in the middle.
Aha! Yep, absolutely.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dan!
Monkey tennis?
Little piss, my foot on the spike.
With a chuckle.
No.
Monkey tennis?
Radical. Awesome. Mega.
Monkey tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Okay.
Monkey tennis?
Edmonds is a total wazzer of a guy.
Yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
They said, who the hell is that?
This is great banter.
Yeah.
Back of the net.
Monkey tennis?
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.